You don't take
explore around
roll
it.
On your.
I mean, you haven't.
I do it very subtly. I actually.
Okay.
I have a
lot of I'm just like, what was your name again?
I've actually gotten very discreet. I've refined a cool technique,
really,
and then
okay.
As people show up late, I'm like, oh,
I'm sorry, we waited.
Yeah. So we do keep attendance, but not in a mean way.
Yeah.
It's
oh.
Nice attendance. Yeah.
My turn.
You're five? Is it five?
It's
not. Oh, at last, it's five. Okay. Is everybody here to hear about GMless role-playing games?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To talk about GMless role-playing games?
Mm-hmm.
I am Ben Robbins. I am going to be, I'm theoretically a panelist. Look at my lovely panel. So this is probably going to be a little more informal. We're going to talk a bunch. I could talk about this for days. I could go on for literally days. Ideally, we'll get some questions, get some participation, because I want to hear what you guys think about this stuff, what your experience is. Just a little background. So I don't know why any of you are here. I have no idea what you guys heard about this or not, so I'm curious about that, but I won't ask that just yet. I'll say I'm doing this because one of the things, like I said, I run a weekly meetup group called Story Games Seattle. And what we do is we are open to the public, and just random people come in and play games. And we have a whole variety of games we play. And the games we play are almost all GMless. And there's very specific reasons we do that. In addition to running Story Games Seattle, I've written I read a game blog, largely written for years. Even back when I did nothing but GMing, I wrote it. I wrote it when I was still a GM, kind of transitioned to now playing GMless games. And I wrote Microscope, which is a GMless game as well. So it's one of those where there's not enough GMless games out there, so eventually you got to start making them. If you want to play them. So. Mm-hmm. And the games up here, in fact, are some of the examples of GMless games that you might have been exposed to. I'm guessing if anybody's heard of GMless games, Fiasco is probably one of the big ones you may have heard of. So just a quick show of hands. How many of you are gamers, play role-playing games, tabletop role-playing games? Easy one. Awesome. That's like well nigh 100% sweet. How many of you mostly play tabletop role-playing games with a GM? Awesome. How many of you have played GMless role-playing games? Excellent. And that's actually awesome. I love that some of you have, but the fact that a bunch of you haven't and yet are very curious about this is you have to...
Would you consider Arkham Horror to be a GMless kind of RPG?
That's a different question. It kind of is. It's more the question, I think, in that case, if it's an RPG. And we're not going to cross that bridge, because that's like deep water. we will be out for days in a storm-tossed sea trying to figure out what an RPG is. And it's a great question, but that's not what we're here to talk about today. So, most of you have only played role-playing games with a GM, right? And so you might be thinking, maybe this is why you've come to this panel, because you're like, how is this possible? How could I have fun playing a role-playing game without a game master? And I've been playing role-playing games for longer than you would probably guess. I GM'd for, you can guess?
Yes.
You know what you guess?
20 years.
30.
20 or 30? Which one was it?
I said 20.
And I said 40.
You said 30?
Yeah.
It's closer to yours. In fact, it is 31, 32, something like that. For 25 of those years, I was GMing. I was the GM, as probably a lot of you are. It's your thing you do. You make the world, you make the game. And it's awesome, and it's super fun. And that's a great thing. Okay, how many people here are like the GM? That's like maybe, not quite 50-50, maybe a third. And the rest of you, I take it, identify primarily as players. Is that right?
Yes.
So nods? Yeah, cool. So when you're the GM and you're going into the game and you're like the creative one, you have spent the last week preparing the game. But it's not the game, right? It's your game. If you play in Ben's game, you say, I played in Ben's game. Ben owns that game. I am a player in Ben's game. And there's a lot of revealed truth in that statement that gives away a lot about what actually goes on in the situation. That the ownership of the game for the people who are players is very, very different than the person who is the GM. And there's nothing wrong with that. Let's go one thing right out of the way. Our goal today is not to bash GM games. Absolutely not. I love GM games. I did it for a zillion years. It's that there is a different way we can play, and that after 30 years, this is still kind of not really... I mean, we're actually 40 years. Role-playing games have been around since about 68, since Bronze Age. GMless games are still kind of this new, strange idea, which is why it's very gratifying to see you guys, even having not tried them, are curious about it. So the dynamic difference cover this a little bit, and then we'll get into kind of why they're awesome. When I show up as a player, what do I own? What do I bring to the game?
A character sheet, dice, and a pen.
Character. I got this thing in my hand, and it is my guy, my dude, my dude, my dudette, my whatever. This is my turf. My turf is this big. It's the size of 1.5 by 11 piece of paper. And the GM owns everything else. And let me ask you another really kind of strange question. You made this character, and you showed up at this game. The GM who prepared this game, when, or at least if you're a GM, you can answer the question. If you're the GM, and you're preparing a game, so you're going to game on Sunday, when did you have to see the character sheets?
Just before, when I bought GM, I asked just before, then I tried to just modify it, make it work out, and go with what I did.
So would you say, in fact, I will say that I as GM for a million years, I can tell you this, I would prepare the game, I could prepare the game in its entirety without ever knowing who the characters are. I could get to the game without ever knowing who the characters are. I could do the intro without ever knowing who the characters are. And that is awesome, that works great. But if you think about that, there's something very weird going on. If you think of the whole thing as a story, there's a story that's going to emerge, things are going to happen. How can you make a story or prepare the structure of the story, the skeleton of the story, without knowing who the protagonists are, who the main characters are? Isn't that, like, bizarre?
Yeah.
Isn't that really kind of blow your mind for a second? And the answer to that is actually kind of simple, that in most adventure games or most tabletop role-playing games that are GM'd, really the player characters are not protagonists. They are reacting. They're what is classically called the antagonist, the one who reacts, or the one who stops. The protagonist acts. The antagonist reacts or retards the action of the protagonist. When you're a player character, you're often not the protagonist. You're an antagonist. You're reacting. You are reacting to the thing that the GM has created. You are participating in their creative ideas. And that can be awesome, because it can be really super fun, and you're kind of seeing this thing unfold, and you get to react to it, and you can chill. You have a very... Here's playing D&D. I can show up. I can relax. I can have an afternoon with my friends. I can just kind of have a good, mellow time. I'm not necessarily forced or called upon to kind of be like... a massive creative contributor. Cool. Keep that in mind, because we're going to leave all that behind. That was dead.
Out the window?
What's that?
Throwing out the window.
We're throwing out the window. Well, we're putting it in a different room. So, because I want to be honest, that with GM-less games, a whole different ball of wax is going to enter in. If there's not a GM, suddenly there's not someone setting this kind of story ahead of time. Often, we talk about how a GM game has all this prep. The person prepared this game, they've set it up ahead of time. In a GM-less game, there's no one to do any prep. There's no one who ahead of time is in charge of doing that. So, and the weird thing about that, or not the weird thing, but the very different thing, is that then when we sit down at the table, instead of being like, oh, it's Ben's game, and we're seeing what Ben has come up with, we're in fact all peers. We're sitting down together, and we're going to make something together. And in fact, the very literal thing of the time commitment that someone's made to making a game, to prepping a game, the reason we honor that is because we should. If a GM spends all week preparing a game, they've put a lot of time into it already, and we should respect that, and we should play to some degree the game that they've prepared. Because it would be really rude to say, yeah, you spent 15 hours working on this game, but we're not going to do that. That would be really kind of inconsiderate. And so if you think of the way the ownership goes, the moment we sit down at the table, the GM has put more time into this than we have. It is only fair that they own the game. That is actually a completely irrational arrangement. There's no way around it, to put it differently. You've got to prepare a game. The GM does own it, and they should, and that's very proper. But it's like I said, so in a GM-less game, we avoid that entirely. We don't have preparation. The game begins when we sit at the table. Many things that would normally be considered like GM prep occur there, in that space between us. Nothing existed until we all sat down. And a lot of times, you'll say, like, well, that's impossible. How could we sit down and all just spontaneously make an entire world for whatever? And one of the ways we do that is that different games will actually have very specific structures to get you synchronized. Because that's really what these games are about. These games are about being on the same page. And if you think about it, in most games, the GM is the person who gets you on the same page. The GM says, this is the plot that I have made, or this is the story. No hobbits, or, you know, you can have a paladin, but in my game, paladins are all elves. And we go, we get it, okay, you're the law, that's the truth. In a GMless game, nobody has that singular authority. We have to work that out together. Or we play a game, some of these games, have built-in premises. They have a shortcut where, for example, like, let's say we were playing Polaris. Polaris has a built-in setting that we can use, and it's a detailed built-in setting. And the built-in setting's job is not to replace our creativity. The built-in setting job is to get us on the same starting point so that we all begin. When we sit down to play, we kind of already know what our agenda is a little bit. So we can kind of, in a way, the rules of the game are taking the place of the GM doing preparation. The game itself is a form of preparation. Other games do the opposite. Other games say, no, in the space of these 4 hours, you're going to sit down and you're going to make an entire fictional world from nothing. It's poof. It's going to appear out of nowhere. And in that couple of hours, you're going to play out what is like an epic movie saga, you know, all of Star Wars in 4 hours, and it's going to be awesome. And your characters may die, you may blow up the world, you could destroy this whole universe. We're not coming back to it. This is a one-shot game. We're building a whole universe, we're blowing it up. It's like every motion picture you've seen that doesn't have a sequel. And the thing about it that so you go like, okay, well, so assume for a second that's possible, again, to how we do that. So let's go back to the difference. When you're a player and you show up and you've got this character sheet, you own the character sheet, but you have this kind of like, this is my turf is right here, and so on the thing. When we sit down together, and we together, say play Shock, for example, and we together make a socially relevant, unique setting out of the blue, like, I didn't come to the game thinking this, I'm surprised I was in the time, boom, we have this whole new thing. What happens is, we, instead of going like, oh, that was a really fun game that Ben made, we look each other in the eye and go, we just made something freaking awesome. And you'll see these things, this happens every week at Story Game Seattle, you'll see people sit down at the table, and they're kind of like back here, and then they get a little aggressive, like, well, this is my idea, I like my idea, and there's a little argument that goes on, and the rules kind of sort that out, and we come to sort of synchronize things. And at the end of the night, people literally want to give each other hugs. You see this look where they're like, that was amazing. And from then on, it's like an experience. I mean, all games are like this to some degree. It's an experience that's not shareable. You say, like, I played this awesome game on Saturday, and the people that were there loved it, but no one else is going to get your war stories. That's just, we're used to that. We're gamers. We know that deal. But in this, it's almost like you've made relevant fiction. Not just fiction about characters, even, but what we call a story. And that's why we often refer to these as story games. They're games where the story comes before the characters. Your character dying is not a big deal if that's good for the story. And you'd be gladly, yes, that'd be awesome if something terrible happened to my character, because that will make a good story. And it's a one-shot, so I don't need to save this character. I'm not defensive. I'm not protective. I'm not having to guard. If anything, the only area in which we compete is kind of in our creative desires. I have a burning desire to have something cool happen. You have a burning desire to have something cool happen. We have this fantastic collision. Which again, you would say this would be a disaster, but the rules are going to sort that out. So is that are you terrified yet about GMless games? No. That's scary. Good. Little. It's without getting too many. I mean, we'll get into the exactly how some of these things work. It is for per hour play, fantastically more potentially rewarding. When you make a character, you kind of show up and you're waiting for your time to bring your step out in these games. Because you are, at the very moment, making the big things, you will literally walk around the table just pretty proud of yourself, is the best way to put it. People show up after work and they're tired, and then they just go away kind of glowing, or they didn't expect to be having a good time. They thought they were going to have a bad day. They thought they were tired. And then you unleash this creative power that they didn't know they have. And in fact, that's another good point. GM games, as we said before, are this kind of like, there's a discrepancy of creative power. The GM is the primary creative driver. They're building a whole world, they're building a plot, they're doing all this stuff. You as a player are responsible for bringing a character and then improvising what your character does on the spot. But your creative participation is pretty specified. In a GMless game, that's not true at all. You're going to be called upon, sometimes uncomfortably so. For example, Microscope, which I made. One of the key traits of it is that it makes you be more creative than you want to be. Seriously. How many people played with people who are the quiet people, the wallflowers? Don't talk much. Hands? Seen some hands? Some of you may be the wallflowers. Love the wallflowers. I love them. Because every time I've GM'd, I know, when I look carefully, in their heart, they are experiencing the fiction. They've got a whole idea of what their character looks like. They've got a deep backstory. They're just not telling anyone. It's in there. And maybe they're not telling anyone because everyone else is talking and they're too loud. Maybe they're not telling anyone because they just don't feel comfortable sharing. But it's in there. Those people are creative. I have no doubts. I've never seen a gamer who was not creative. They just haven't had that voice. And one of the things that happens in these games is that they have structures, usually, that at some point puts you in the hot seat. It's your turn. I'm pointing. Okay. And it's your turn, and you get to go. And in some games, there's a little more free play. In Microscope, for example, it will literally put you in the hot seat, and now you get to make something really big. And we are not even allowed to, like, cajole you or give you suggestions, because if we give you suggestions, a quiet person will fall back on just letting, oh, yeah, that's a great idea, I'll go with your idea. But if you shut up and go, like, nope, it's on you, and wait, a couple minutes will pass, there'll be sweat and tears, silence, agony, a burning redness about the forehead. And then, and I've seen this happen time and again, they will say something that will surprise the hell out of you. You will go, I have game with this dude for 10 years. I have never heard him say something so cool before. I feel robbed. Like, what have you been doing for 10 years? Why weren't you doing that in every game we played? Dude, and the thing is, the person who does it, they're not like, that was a great idea. They're like, oh, yeah, this is a thing, and it's like a Cold War, but the secret agent is Sionic. And I'm like, what? they're not confident. And that's cool. But the idea comes out, and then the fascinating thing that happens is the beauty of it. They put their idea out there. Put it out there kind of, gingerly. And then the rest of us take it, and we build on it. We take that seed of an idea, and we're like, yeah, that's awesome, and, the different factions are named this, and here's this plot, what happened with this guy, he's loved this woman, rah, rah, rah. And 2 hours later, that person who inserted this very small seed, it's maybe a snowball's a better example, it is accrued, it's accumulated, and that person's like, wow, that idea that I didn't think was that great, these other people have reaffirmed over and over and over again. And because it's not just, like, one person's idea, it's just, like, it was your idea, but then I added this idea, and then you added this idea, and you added this idea. At the end, ownership becomes extremely unimportant. It's our idea. And that's where I think the social bonding of it occurs. You actually are looking at each other and going, like, we made this together. There's a flip side of that, which is that it doesn't always work. And this is the... Remember before we started when I said, like, this next hour could be the best panel of your life, or it could suck? That is true of these games as well. Because, so when you're playing a GM game, right, the GM says, like, no, you're not doing that, or, okay, no, you guys are out of line. The GM is the person running the game, but the person controlling the game. They're the ones who will rein it back in if people are slow or listless or bored. They're the ones who have the job of kind of keeping it back on the rails. In a GM-less game, no one has that authority. But then again, I mean, like, okay, this is a GM situation. I'm the GM right now. You guys are in this weird position, and you kind of have to listen to me talk. And if someone acted up, I would go, could you please leave the room? But we're adults. Do we really need it to be this way? If we all formed a big circle and just talked, would we? This is a lot of people for a game, so, say there's 4 of us. Could we manage it? Could we manage to behave
easily.
Socially? Easily? Yeah. I mean, do you guys go out to dinner with people, a group of 4, and start knife fighting?
All the time, right.
There was that one time, but we don't talk about it. Yeah, always the guy who orders the steak, you get to be like, what's he want that knife for? Yeah, so we were kind of trained to believe, I think, that because we have a GM, that the GM, we need somebody to keep things on the rails. We need somebody to act as, not rules referee, social referee. Social enforcer, social arbiter, to keep us all up. To say who can talk. That's one of the creepiest things I think about being the GM, is your job is to tell people, like, nope, you don't talk, you talk, it's your turn. Not like turns like initiative, like, you've talked a bunch, now you go. I mean, GMs, you guys do that, right?
Yep.
You got it. It's your job. It's mandatory. And you know what's cool? In a way, that's a great thing, because it means the players, don't take this the wrong way. This is going to sound wrong, but this is with a lot of love. When you do that, you're allowing the players to be jackasses, which is awesome. Because then the players are like, I no longer have social authority to have to worry if anyone's feelings are hurt, because the GM will take care of that. The GM is driving the car, the rest of us can kick back and listen to mixtapes. In a way, that's a very awesome social scenario. You're taking a lot of pressure off of the individual to have to care about the group. And that's one style. And that's, again, that can be awesome. In a GMless game, the whole you're not doing that at all. You're required. In fact, if in a normal game you're back here as a character, in a GMless game you kind of have to be up here. You have to be leaning in. You have to be kind of coming to agreement. And there will be, like I said, it will not always work. There'll be times where you're looking at someone and going like, we're not clicking. I do not understand what they're saying. I do not get why they're reincorporating these creative ideas that I do not like. And because of that, there are in fact whole systems of logic, rule systems, and more social systems designed to handle those disagreements. Don't get me wrong. When I say GMless games, I don't mean like, let's just all talk randomly and make something up. That is not what we're doing at all. There are very specific rules about who gets to go when. For example, one of the most common things in all these games will be, if you start playing these games, you'll see this a lot. Conflict resolution! There's a conflict, let's resolve it. Conflict resolution generally means we have a disagreement about what we would like to have happen in the story. The simplest form is like, my guy's trying to do something and you think he shouldn't succeed, so let's roll for it. But a more broad case could be like, I think these aliens should be cannibals. Someone else is like, I don't want to go down that path. I don't think they should be cannibals. We have a creative conflict. We have a disagreement about which way the story should go. Different systems will resolve that differently. For example, like in Shock, we will actually just use dice, and we'll determine that. And different people will have different levels of input depending on their creative power at the time. So it's not just a free-form, let's just make up stuff and all be really cool, and if we're not cool, the whole thing rolls apart. There's very specific structures for how we're going to resolve this kind of thing. I've asked before, so two of you have played GMless RPGs. Have you heard of specific GMless RPGs?
Fiasco?
Mm-hmm.
Polaris, excellent. Polaris, it's... Okay, so Fiasco is the breakout hit. Fiasco is the game that's probably made GMless RPGs known to people who may never have heard of them before. Fiasco is also fascinating because it is reveals a lot of things that, in fact, were not necessary in gaming, which I won't get into deep theory. Actually, let's ask, who wants to hear what's fun about gaming? And who wants to hear about deep theory? Show of hands. Deep theory?
Deep theory?
Who wants to hear what's fun?
Deep.
Wow, you guys are a weird group. That's bizarre. Who wants to hear charming anecdotes about the last game I played?
Who wants to my cat?
So I should mention that with regards to deep theory and all this kind of stuff, listening to me talk is going to maybe whet your appetite about this, but it's not really going to. It's going to maybe make you realize that your expectations of what will happen in a GM game are not what will happen in a normal game. But there is no substitute for actually playing these games. In fact, literally no substitute. You may hate them. We don't know. You've got to play. And to that end, downstairs, down the lower level in the gaming area, Story Game Sale has we got six tables. We got tables and tables and tables. And there's rafts of volunteers down there right now who will play games with you. And what they will do is called facilitating. It's very important. When you're the facilitator, you're the person who knows the rules. You've read the book. You've played it before. You know the drill. And you're willing to teach other people how to play this game. But you are not the GM. You don't have the authority to say, nope, your idea isn't cool. You have the authority to say, like, oh, we're playing the rules wrong, let me explain better. But it's a very different role. And sometimes the facilitator will even say, like, we're making a mistake, let me back up, or that's really not what this game is intended for. But the difference is that person is not deciding creatively. Deciding that is up to you. And if you are interested in the stuff that we're talking about, or if you hate it and want to throw rocks, that's the place to go.
Are there rocks provided?
You know what? We brought a lot of stuff to this con, and rocks was like, I brought paper and not rocks, and I brought scissors. So I'm like, I got like two of the three covered. But you'll see there's a big old sign, big green sign, and friendly volunteers willing to help you play these games. And you can sit down for 15 minutes, just talk about them, play for an hour, play for a couple of hours. And that's one of the things about these games that is, like I said before, that's fantastic, is that you're playing a GM game. You make your character. You've got this idea in your mind. Like, maybe in the long run, I would like my paladin to level up and eventually, you know, maybe become a noble. It's going to happen in playtime. Maybe it will take 2+ years game time. How many sessions of gaming will I have to do that? In a GMless game or story games, because they're often one-shots and they're often directly focused on the story and about the protagonist, you will say at the beginning of the game, my story goal of this guy is I want him to become the king. and avenge himself against his brother. That's going to happen in like 45 minutes, if even that long. You will literally, there's a thing where we literally cut to only the good bits. I'm not even kidding. Only the good bits. So, all of these games do this. There's not a story game I know of that doesn't do this. You say, what is this scene? This is the scene where I confront my fiancée about whether she's cheating on me. None of this, like, well, I'm sitting around the house and seeing what's going on. You cut straight to what would be in the movie, the fascinating parts. And what's even more fascinating is that you tell the other players what the point is. You don't say, like, well, we'll just play for a while. Okay, let me back up a sec. When I'm the GM, I have my secret plot. I don't tell you. It is my secret plot. Right? Yeah. And part of the game is you find out my secret plot. You're like, I think Ben's got a secret plot, and if we just keep going, we're gonna figure out what the point of this is. But like, if I have my secret plot, like, you're gonna figure it out game 15, games 1 through 10, you're still like, we fought a bunch of orcs, it was really cool, I like that. And the GM's like, no, just. And I mean, I've done this, I do this, it's a thing. But it's a, as a GM, we often don't realize how much people have no idea what our games are about, because we haven't told anybody. It's our big secret. When you take away the fact that one person is making this secret contribution, and you, in fact, are openly collaborating in a story design, all of that's on the table square one. If you say, I want it to be, this the story arc of this character is going to be like, coming to terms with her humanity. Is she human or is she alien? You tell us right off the bat. We go, awesome, that's the topic of this movie we're making, the story we're making. We're going to explore that now. And in fact, even if our characters don't know, even if this character we're talking about doesn't know she's half alien, we, the authors of the story, do. And we make the story go that direction. We have awesome conversations where, like, her best friend comes in and goes, isn't it great to be human? I'm so glad I'm a full-blooded human. dramatic irony, like, yes, it's great, buddy, that we're both humans. You have these where we as the players know that we're setting up this tension, and the characters, the poor characters. But it's like every movie you've ever seen. And then when the reveal comes out, the person's like, oh, Dracula. But if you stop and compare those two, right, in the one, the GM's over here with the secret, and we players are just in the dark. And eventually we're going to go, that was really cool with the alien thing. That's great, but I found that out 10 games later. In this, we're all playing at an intelligent level with that. We're being, in fact, required to listen to the other people, listen to the cool idea they want to introduce, and incorporate it, to reincorporate it. It's a totally different mental process that's going on right at the time. And getting back to that whole thing of, like, the GM secret plots, just GMing style. Go ask your players. Like, pick a campaign you really liked. Or as players, let me ask you this. Awesome campaign where the GM's like, yeah, game 40, this thing happened. The players don't remember any of that stuff. They're like, remember that time on the bridge when it was me and that troll, and I was like, get back, troll. And the GM's like, that was a wandering monster. That was awesome! Because I fought that troll, and I was like, get back, I will not let you kill my brother. And then I stabbed him. Yeah, that was cool. The player's experience and the GM's experience are, in fact, not synchronized at all. The GM is like, yeah, get to my plot. And the player's like, no, I am living in the skin of my character, experiencing this world and having a good time and being alive. I'm being my character. And the GM's like, hurry up and get to my plot. So you see, there's a very sad... It's going to end in tears. It's a sad relationship. It's very difficult. And again, like in a GM's game, none of that exists. In fact, the core job, you might say, so we give this little spiel when people come to story games, we give a little talk, because the biggest problem in playing GM's games is the expectations of having played GM games and thinking you're supposed to do X when, in fact, all those rules are out the window. One of the biggest jobs, and this it seems very obvious, talk and listen. Being creative is not the top job. You can be creative as hell. It doesn't do you any good if you cannot convey that creativity to the other people at the table. You get a great idea, but you can't communicate it, or you're communicating in a way they don't get, it will not be made part of the story. It will not be incorporated. It will not happen. You'll see the failure. You'll see the disconnect of that communication, and your idea will fail. Whereas if you have really kind of even just simple ideas, but you can explain, my guy is unhappy. Everyone's like, oh, I get it. Your guy's unhappy. Awesome. I can work with that. All of which is to say, the creative threshold isn't as high as you may think sometimes. You don't have to be, you know, the Mozart of role-playing games to play these games and have fun. You just have to be able to talk and have a conversation and communicate even something like this very quickly. So don't be so afraid. We'll have a little pause for a second so I can get some questions for you guys. But I do want to point out one thing, speaking of being afraid. So when we play GM games, and GM makes the plot, the GM decides like what the topic of the game is, right, as they're supposed to. The GM will pick whatever they want to incorporate into the story. The GM might be, it'll be awesome, because then they'll discover that there's two factions, and it's really a racism, you know, parable about the, you know, the gnomes and the dwarves, but they hate each other. It's about racism. The GM decided that. I didn't get a vote. I just showed him, like, oh, this is about racism. Okay, great. Again, because when we're playing GMless games, we're deciding as a group. Like, let's say Shock, for example. Let me explain how Shock works briefly. Have any of you ever heard of Shock?
Heard of.
Shock is frickin' awesome. It is the most awesome game no one plays. This is kind of our list of games we make people play. We make them play it. Like, you don't get your badge until you play all these games. All for totally different reasons. They're totally different. Shock. Let me tell you what I think is, in fact, fantastic about Shock. How many people have seen, like, the original Planet of the Apes? Charlton Heston. Planet of the Apes. What's it about? It's about apes? Apes on a planet, right? That's awesome. Great movie, right? But it's
our planet.
And that's why it's a classic. Yeah. But in fact, if you take a step back, you go like, well, it's not about apes at all. It's science fiction. The apes are a veneer through which we can address real world issues. It's about racism. It's about equality. It's totally about racism. It's a big time about racism. It's about race issues. It's about, you know, humanity. Shock. In fact, little known thing, you know, which was the third and fourth in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the one where they go back through the time capsule and it's back on Earth and the humans are raising apes as servants, but then the apes riot and get free. They released that like in the late 60s, and the first release is the one where they all rise up and start killing all the people, and people watch it and said, oh my god, this is basically a cry for people to rise up and riot. For black people to rise up and kill white people. And they're like, oh my god, I can't believe we made that movie. And if you watch it, they voice over, and the main character says again, on second thought, no, bide our time, wait. true story. That's actually in the movie. They this voiceover, or what's his face, says like, no, let's not riot just yet. Let's riot later. After the 60s. maybe later on we'll riot. But the point is that science fiction, classic science fiction, is about real world issues told through the lens of science fiction, right? The lens is a safety, kind of a nice barrier, so we feel comfortable talking about it. Like, we might be comfortable talking about racism, but we're comfortable talking about Charlton Heston with some apes, because it's a safer zone. Shock is that game. Shock is the game where you basically start off, the very first thing you do and sit down is you say, what issues do we want to talk about? Each person brings an issue. The issues can be things like, I want to talk about marriage, I want to talk about mortality, I want to talk about class inequality. You pick these issues blindly from each other, and then you take them all together, and you brainstorm a shock or something different from the normal world, the thing that diverges from the normal world in this fictional world we're making, that addresses those. So for example, like, throw out some issues, and these are issues that would affect individuals or society as a whole.
Obamacare,
or let's call it universal health care of some kind. Or what do you want, enforced health care?
Yeah.
Cool. Enforced health care?
Mind control.
Marriage equality?
Awesome. Oh my god. Take those three, and just sit quietly, and don't say anything for a second, and now imagine a science fiction setting where there's something different about the world that pushes those three buttons. Dun, 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 dun. That's an easy one, frankly. That one, we could go around and around. That would be fantastic. The thing is, like, I would never have thought to make a story about those three issues. But as we sit and I say, okay, so if it's mandatory health care but also mind control, are people being mind controlled to have health care? That would be obvious. or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe the mind control is a result of universal health care. We start to twist it like taffy. And then 15 minutes later, we're suddenly like, oh my gosh. Like, one of the very first Shock games I played was about unemployment and unemployment, genetic success, and what was the last one? But the point was, we were like, oh, well, so the premise is like only like class inequality. The rich people get cryogenic storage. If you're rich, you can be put in cryogenics while the economy, while the environment's collapsing, you'll come out later. And the other person was like, no, flip it. What if the poor people get put on ice? If you can't keep a job, they freeze you. They're like, oh! Oh, no! No! I'm like, that is genius!
Well, you realize that Dr. Who did that, right?
Well, we probably beat Dr. Who. Actually, that's another rule. Never bring up Star Trek. That's another rule. And Dr. Who is a corollary of that. It's the point, really, that I might have been a million years thought of that. It's not even that it's so unique. It's at that particular moment, our brains have synthesized. We've had this, like, that was incredible. And the table across from us is like, what are you guys talking about? Like, that's awesome with this thing. And they're like, yeah. To us, we've now made this completely novel, fantastic universe in a couple of minutes. And then we're like, now, characters. Who are the people in that story? What do they go through during that process? I just had a 15-minute signal. That went really fast. Let's do questions.
What are the four games up to?
The four games, these are our stellar examples. Polaris, because it's awesome about showing you how to antagonize. Antagonize is the process in which you push another character to difficult decisions, which their character hates, but their player loves. Tough choices. Tough choices that are that moment that there's a face that people make. Decision. Do I take the throne, but my lieutenant dies? Tough decision. Polaris is genius for that. There's a bunch of things about it that are cool. Fiasco is the breakout hit. It is the lightest of all GMless games. It is the easiest. Just pick, set it down and play. It's also very nice because it is set in the real world. You're like a bunch of college kids behind a 7-Eleven. There's a bunch of different cases it can be. But it's a very easy real world. You don't have to make a fantastic universe, so it's very easy for people to jump in and play it. It's a very light system. And it's a dark comedy. It's about people with poor impulse control. So it's people love funny. People having sex with alligators is awesome. It was true love. I didn't at first believe it, but actually as the game went on, I believe he really did love the crocodile. There's a crocodile. There's a transplanted crocodile to North America. The game was not supposed to be about that. We thought it was going to be about drug running, but no, it was about crocodile love. And the crocodile went crazy and ate the drum major. Oh, that's terrible. That's Fiasco in a nutshell. Is when people are just laughing hysterically and rolling on the floor, and the characters are dying horribly, going to jail on drug addiction. So then, Shock. We just talked about Shock. Is the other end of the spectrum. Shock is about. It's about examining real-world social issues that you care about through the lens of fiction, and it will knock your frickin' socks off. Played a lot of Shock, and I've never played the same game Shock twice. Fantastic. In Microscope, I'm a bit weird about it since I wrote it, so I'll try to describe it neutrally. It's a game of epic history, where you basically, you read an entire, the Dune series, you read the entire thing, all the books. You know, that's a lot of pages. This is a game where basically you make that entire worldscape in a couple of hours. One of the key things about it is that you make the history from the outside in. You start off with an overview of all of history. You might say, like, the rise and fall of a great empire. You know very little about it. And as you play, you go back and you pick the spots of the history that you're fascinated by and you drill down. So you go all the way to, like, saying, well, we know the emperor was overthrown. Let's find out who did it. And let's find out, well, now that we know it's his son, why did his son do it? And now let's go back 30 years to when the father first had the son, was raising him, and he was on his knee, and what conversation did they have that led to these things? So it's this process where you go backwards, forwards, exploring the stuff that you're interested in, and you have vast creative powers fails to describe how vast your creative powers are. And one of the weird things, this is the true hot seat game. This is the, it will make you sweat and be creative, and you may discover you are a genius and didn't know it. That's what the game is designed to do. The reason it works is because it's not played in chronological order. In a normal game, if you do something that screws up the game, like, I say the city blows up, everyone's like, ah, crap, we need that city. Oh, fine, I don't need that city anymore. Thanks, Doug. Good job. Sorry to say your name, Doug. And you're like, well, great, thanks for destroying that city. In Microscope, you go, awesome, okay, great, the city, we now know when the city was destroyed. Ooh, nuclear fire, it's gone. Awesome, let's go back to a month before the explosion. Let's go back to 10 years before the explosion. It's never out of the game. We can always keep playing the time before that. In fact, knowing a character has died is awesome. Step one, introduce the prophet. The prophet dies. Great. Let's go back and explore the prophet's life leading up to the death. And in fact, destroying something never takes it out of the game, because you can always go back to the past and explore more. So that's the. Those are our four. Like they cover a totally different spectrum of style of play each one. Questions?
So you being the GM for a million years,
I'm like 25.
Imagine you had trouble transitioning to GM-less games.
Yeah.
Did you have trouble with wanting to keep all of the creative control? Or what
yes.
did you do to help transition?
It's painful. In fact, it's very hard. The people who have the hardest time playing GM's games are people who have played GM games. People who've never played a role-playing game before, this makes sense. GMing doesn't make sense to them. If you say, in fact, that's why we do these meetups. If you have people walk in the room and say, hey, it's gonna be, this game is going to be awesome, but I'm going to tell you the law. People are like, whoa, that's not cool. But you sit down and say, we're all peers, people are like, that's great. Cool, I'm great. And yes, as a traditional either a player, players tend to be very. The danger is to be too passive and be like, oh, I must ask permission to do things. And as a GM, there's this. You'll see this friction. You'll see people come in, and I went through this myself. I got a great idea, and you have to overcome this. Like, no, but if you let go, you will in fact get much better results, because you'll see these creative things other people make. And actually, the rules will also make it happen. The rules will stop you from being too control freak. But it's some people jump right in. Some people I've had rage quits. I've had people literally go, "That was terrible. That was the worst thing ever." It just did not. They were not. It was not what they liked, and they left. And that's totally okay. Totally happens. But it's rare. Oh, sorry, you had a question. There's a question in the back.
Yeah, you. It seems like most of these are kind of like one shot for the session, and then that's kind of it. Is there any element of an ongoing campaign for these? Or, I mean, maybe for the way you described Microscope, I suppose you could kind of look at different elements of the same campaign world.
Yes.
But each one of those is going to be one shot. It's never going to be last time we kind of had a cliffhanger ending, and now we're going to pick it up.
Right. It's a good question. In fact, some of it is a historical trend, because we've always had campaign games. We never really had really good one-shot games. So in a way, there's a focus towards making it be more like about the protagonist, about a one-shot story, to have these big arcs. But it doesn't have to be that way. In fact, Polaris doesn't require, it's in fact designed to be a multiple sessions. We play one-shot all the time. I think there's definitely a totally fruitful area for playing these games multi-session. It's more this kind of, because we haven't had one-shot opportunities in the past, playing them one-shot is great. And we tend to play them one-shot at a time, because we get that, like, people can walk in, no commitment, sit down, play. 4 hours later, magic has happened, boom. But it's not impossible, it's just that's the current trend based on change of pace. Question?
So I have a group I play with right now who always want to be the same characters. So
yeah.
We play in different settings, they always want to be the same characters. Is that
cool.
Something that they could do with this?
Yeah, well, what will happen is you pull a fast one on them, and not everyone's going to like these games. It's not fair to say to your existing traditional group, you must play these new games. You got to see, maybe they won't like them, maybe they will. Some of these games, like Fiasco is a good one for this, it will almost immediately break you out of these kind of patterns. Even if you're into GM games, there's a GM game called In a Wicked Age by Vincent Baker, the same guy that did Apocalypse World and Dogs of Vader. He's the best guy writing GM games. If you're GMing and you're not reading Vincent Baker, you're missing out. Wicked Age has this fascinating thing where you don't get to just pick a character. You actually deal these oracle cards that set up a situation and include built-in implied characters. Like, one person might be the dark god, one person might be the traitor within the king's court, one person might be the person being sacrificed on the altar. You then have to pick one of those people to play. So it pushes you already outside of that safety zone. Likewise, some of these games, the implied situation will... You will not just be like, I get to pick my character. You make the situation first in the world, and then certain characters will obviously apply or be compatible, and some will just be right out. But don't feel bad if awesome people who like GM games don't want to come along and play GMless games. I have a lot of friends who I've played GM games with for decades, and it's not in their fun zone. And that's totally cool. Totally cool. My question?
It sounded like you're going to start expanding on character creation.
I could go on for days.
So I kind of want to know more about that. Like, how does character creation come about?
Character, they're the protagonist. Characters follow the situation. Situation comes first. World comes first. Theme comes first. You don't say like, "Hey, what's your character?" I'm a ninja. Oh, this is going to be a 18th century period piece. and in fact, a lot of these games have very specific. They all are very different, but some have very specific predispositions. Like Polaris, you're always going to be a knight. It's a gimme. There's no questions asked. You're a knight. It's just kind of like, let's add a little flavor, but you're playing this very stereotyped character. Shock, what you are is going to be completely based on the world you've made. You're going to make some sort of an arc that applies. In fact, you're going to have to make a character that applies to one of the issues you picked. One of the issues is marriage equality, was that it? You're going to pick that issue and say, my character has a story arc that addresses that issue in the game world. I'm going to have to make something that fits that. Microscope, you don't have characters. You'll play characters, you'll play many characters, but you never own a character. You're playing characters temporarily in a particular scene. If we came back to that character again in that scene, someone else might play that same guy, which can be fascinating in and of itself. But the rules, and this to touch on your question too, all of these games are addressing a similar question in totally different ways. You might play one and go like, "Oh, I played Fiasco and I liked it, and then I played Polaris and I didn't like it." They're all very different, so it's very important to try them. Try them twice. Once doesn't count, because once you're absorbing rules, you're not having fun. You're having some fun, but you're paying a lot of attention to information. You've got to play them twice to even have an opinion. Just saying. Which means technically you have to play 8 games. You guys are busy. You've got a lot to do.
So you're here all weekend.
You're here all day. And this is just some. I mean, this is just sort of like our central ones. There's a bunch more as well. Other questions? We're like very short on time, but yeah?
What's the average amount of time it takes for a GMless game?
We play 3 to 4 hours. 3 hours, you will have a hoot of a time. Some people will say 2 hours is great. Corollary to that is number of players. The fewer, because you want creative participation, fewer players is better. A 6-player game sucks. Because you are only 1/6 of the people talking. A 3-player game can be awesome because you are now 1/3 of the people talking. So there's always a tendency of like more and more people. In D&D, if you're like, well, we're just marching down hallways or whatever, you can have a big group. If you want people to creatively contribute to a big story arc, you need fewer people. 3 to 4 is like the sweet spot. 5 sometimes works in some games. If you ask, would be more of a 5. Can work 5. 6 gets a little like, this was a mistake. And there are even some awesome 2-player story games, and even ones that aren't about romance, which is amazing. Mars Colony, fantastic 2-player game about, more like Shock, because it's about politics or civics, through the lens of someone trying to save Mars Colony from its destruction. Fantastic stuff.
So with it being a GMless game and not focused so much on the character, how much is there still an aspect of actually having a pencil and paper in front of you?
Yeah, it varies. I mean, generally, if in one-shots, there's less tracking of details. A lot of systems tend to be much more streamlined, much more like, we're only tracking something that's critical to the system. For example, in Polaris, one of the primary things you're tracking is the zeal of this character. The character, it's tragedy. The character's always going to go from zeal to kind of, like, despair. So that's the main thing we're tracking. We don't care about hit points. That's a good point. Most of these games, death is not even an issue. You know, like in D&D, like, oh, I messed up. I'm dead. I've lost my authoritative power in this game because I died. I was paralyzed. I'm out of the game for a couple of rounds. Does not exist. You cannot lose your ability to speak in these games. You have, you are participating, and you'll participate kind of no matter what. You can't make a mistake that will kick you out of the game. You can't make a mistake that's going to make you talk less. You, the player, have a certain percentage vote of what's going to happen. It's not going to go away just because your character did poorly.
So it's kind of the same question. What mechanics are the same?
Concepts will often be the same. They'll be general, like conflict resolutions are common, but not even all these. I mean, half these have it, half them don't. Scene framing is a very common one. Again, like a movie style, let's get to the meat. We call it scene framing. Like, what's happening right now, right there? Who's there? That's very common for all these games.
Dice?
No. 50-50. Fiasco has dice, doesn't use them. They're pretend dice. No dice. Polaris, there's a die that we look at. We're almost wrapping up, and Shock does have dice. But it varies a lot. Some have dice, some don't. And I think with that, you awesome people, give yourself a round of applause for... But seriously, play downstairs. It's the only way, maybe not now, maybe when you're ready, take the time out. That's the only way to find out. Thank you all. Well, this weekend we're downstairs. I think they're going to try to have a little bit of a meeting.